Plato, podcasts, and place. These are a few of my favorite things. As a professor with a PhD in rhetoric and composition, the first usually generates polite nods, but my sympathies and fascination for Plato and his rhetorical facilities and epistemological sensibilities remain, despite his relentless castigation of my field. He loves us, but he'll just never admit it. As a man who is part of many fan communities and who loves stories and stays updated on politics, the second is rather inevitable. This love does not generate polite nods, but usually generative conversations at social gatherings about the specific podcast series and episodes that are absolute must-listens. This has remained constant across all three places I've lived. Windsor, Ontario, Canada, where I was born, raised, and got my master's degree. Tampa, Florida, where I did my PhD. And now Norfolk, Virginia, where I am now, working as an assistant professor at Old Dominion University. Which takes me to my third love listed, place. Having lived, as many in my profession have, in multiple entirely distinct places, I am fascinated at how municipalities create, or have created for them, specific identities. To borrow from Jenny Edbauer's thinking on rhetoric and place, how do we trace a given city's affective ecologies? How do city identities get created, and who gets to create them? And by which media or modalities do we learn about them? Perhaps this fascination stems from my experience being raised in Windsor, which many refer to as the armpit of Canada, not so affectionately, but I like to think of it more as the twilight zone of North America, where Canadians use Fahrenheit to measure temperature, and where you cross over into the United States by heading north. But that is neither here nor there. What is here, here being Norfolk,
downtown Norfolk.
This is Norfolk, Virginia.
Norfolk is a town
in Norfolk.
Welcome to Norfolk.
Whoa, sorry. Did you hear that too, or was that just me? Seems every time I utter the word Norfolk.
Today I'm in Norfolk, Virginia.
The other ways the city gets pronounced circulate in my mind. It is weird, not Austin weird, and definitely not Portland weird, but weird to live in a town where you might walk from your house to get a cup of coffee on the way to the university and hear your neighbor, the barista, and your students all pronounce the city in which we all live differently. And everyone is, like, kind of cool about it. Although the moment you utter the city name, you out yourself as one who hails from one part of town or another, or as an outsider who tries to get it close, or an outsider who just doesn't care and who opts for phonetic consistency. Anyways, let's try that again. What is here is the course I taught a few semesters back titled Writing in Digital Spaces. While I don't often get to teach a course that integrates three of my favorite things, I can't imagine a class, for example, that resides at the intersection of hockey, turn-of-the-century post-hardcore music and whiskey, but maybe that's for a project out at a later date. This class indeed did, as students read Plato's Phaedrus, thought about place, and then podcasted about it. The course, naturally, had intentional design. It was not just a slapdash potpourri of my interests. While the practical production stream of the class focused on podcasts, more on that later, web writing, and Twitter, the theoretical framework was built around Walter Ong's book, Orality and Literacy, The Technologizing of the Word, which provides a rather persuasive analytical account of how cultures transitioned from oral to literate modalities and how they experience a transformation of consciousness as a result. Literacy, the very technologizing of the word, Ong argues, produces patterns of thought that become normalized and naturalized. These patterns of thought are distinct from those of oral cultures, with particular distinction noticed in the way we tell stories. So, when students were creating podcasts of the city, of an object, history, person, or building within the city limits in Norfolk, they were thinking about the storytelling structures that help create a particular municipal mythos. They were synthesizing orality with what Gregory Ulmer coins the third apparatus. Orality is the first, literacy is the second, and electricity is the third. Electricity is an apparatus where the practice is not religion or science, but entertainment. And the institution is not the church or school, but the internet. In drawing connections between Plato's reservations in the Phaedrus about written text and its potentially erosive effects on memory, Ong's in-depth analysis of the distinction between oral and literate cultures, and Ulmer's speculative space generated by his vision of electricity, students were asked to ruminate on how digital technologies offer our world and our cities an opportunity to productively resequence the seemingly distant mode of orality with and through a fuller embrace of digital writing technologies. This, the course argued, happens, potentially, through production. It happens through podcasting. The popularity and production of podcasts, students would hopefully realize, are connected in meaningful but complicated ways to ancient allegiances to orality, and perhaps represent a return or revisioning of orality for our digitally mediated culture. Now, the podcasts students generated were quite impressive. Topics varied. One group sought to explain why the city symbol is a mermaid despite all the dearth of beaches. Another explored a historical cemetery embedded within the city, divided by a literal wall between the races of the dead. Another explored the glass studio extension of our local art museum. And another went in depth on how and why people of this city pronounce its name differently. People were called, linguists were consulted, research was done. The ideas, the scripts, the attention to story structure, all were impressive. Especially given when asked on the first day of class who listened to podcasts, two hesitant hands were raised. As I sit here in a soundproof audio recording booth in our campus's technology and distance education building, I can't help but think that my biggest regret with the podcast series we produced and made available for public consumption on SoundCloud, search if you wish for our series of Norfolk, is the lack of attention I paid to production. The class was quite immersed in theory, quite immersed in analyzing podcast story structures and articulating carefully how students might structure their own and why. And that attention to things such as high-quality microphones, recording spaces, ambient noises, and enunciation kind of took a back seat. In 15 weeks, it was challenging to attend to both storytelling and production quality. Not that they are as divided as we might think, given how your listening experience has plummeted a little right now, since I'm using my iPhone outside in Norfolk. Students certainly learn to appreciate the amount of time required to produce even a 15-minute podcast, which is good. And they learned about rhetorical theory and generated great discussion about orality, literacy, and electricity. Also good, and not easy. But with podcasts, even I was surprised at how absolutely crucial sound quality is to the success of a podcast. Seems simple, right? Seems like I should have maybe thought about that before, maybe. But when you have seven groups of two going around the city, as they were encouraged to do, equipment becomes an issue. Access becomes an issue. The very nature of the place-based podcast took them out of the classroom, out of the quiet, and left them susceptible to technological considerations we didn't explicitly cover. Background noise, proximity of microphones. We covered the use of Audacity, yes, as you could see in the write-up, but the actual on-site quality of recordings was lacking, as you yourself can attest if you choose to listen. And when I reflect on this project and that semester, I oscillate between two positions. On one hand, not really caring about the production quality of the podcast, because the key learning objectives were met, and students engaged quite impressively with the readings, concepts, and projects as a whole. They bought in. And then on the other hand, really caring, since the idea of the podcast project was to make a series for public consumption that, hopefully, might help reframe or challenge existing perceptions of the city. While production quality was not a major criterion for assessment in my evaluation of the podcast, when they cross over into more public spheres, such as sharing the playlist on Facebook or Twitter, or sending it to the people and places included in the episodes, there was a tinge of hesitancy. What people might think of the project, of our school, of our program, if little attention was paid to the production of the podcast. Other questions I asked myself. Should I even ever have done this project in the first place, knowing our department didn't have the means necessary for all students to produce high quality in terms of production work? Should I have just spent the entire semester on the podcast project, letting go of the others to afford more time to figure out the technology? How important is the production quality in terms of public perception? How much of my teaching should be spent in Audacity and researching technology? What role or restrictive capacity does the type of technology we have access to have in our teaching, in our decision to design projects and courses in the first place? I cannot give you answers to these questions, but they sure make darn good discussion questions for the next time I teach this course and project.